Hi, this is Mark, jumping in to say that unfortunately, I'm ending the podcast on June 1st. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. I won't have time to finish the current season, the performance of my novel, The Big Wake Up. But if you are interested in reading the final 8 chapters of the book, I have the following free offer. Join my newsletter at markcoggins.com/newsletter and enter podcast in the optional message field, and I will email you the ebook version of the novel. Again, go to my website at markcoggins.com, select the newsletter menu item, give your name and email address with podcast in the message field, and I'll get back to you with the ebook. Thank you again for listening. And consider checking out the latest August Reardon book, Geisha Confidential, which was released earlier this year. Bye for now. Mark. No Hard Feelings by Mark Coggins is a bang bang thrill ride, says best-selling author Seth Harwood, who adds that the lead character of Winnie is a female Jack Reacher. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 35. Winnie. Winnie felt lightheaded from despair. The pain in her jaw and a lack of oxygen from Sergi's crushing embrace. Her face was tingly and numb. Her field of view narrow and murky. She wasn't dreading what the winemaker and his Ukrainian slaves were poised to do to her as much as she feared being paralyzed again. Paralyzed and then dead, with the winemaker in possession of the stimulator technology. He would win, and she would lose. She must have blacked out for a moment because the next thing she knew, Anatoly was slicing off her tracksuit with a box cutter. He made a hash of the job, desire and innate clumsiness causing him to fumble and score the skin of her legs. When at last he was finished, he dropped the knife and reached for her panties. With Sergi's arm still clamped around her torso, she brought her legs up to kick at Anatoly's face, but even a crushing shot to his nose didn't stop him from yanking them to her ankles.
"Idiot," snapped the winemaker, who remained by the wheelchair. "The transceiver first. It's got to be under the vest."
Anatoly seemed not to hear him. He stared at the place her panties had been and reached to insinuate a hand between her legs.
"Damn you," said the winemaker.
He lowered himself into the chair and fumbled beneath his jacket. Winnie was too busy kicking to see exactly what the winemaker did next, but a blank look came over Anatoly's face, and he moved purposefully, almost robotically, beyond her reach. It was clear the winemaker had taken control. Anatoly picked up the box cutter and approached from the side. Sergi clamped a paw over her face and pulled her head back to make it easier to get to the fabric of her vest. The renewed pressure on her jaw was excruciating, and she felt herself losing consciousness once more. She wished she would pass out and never wake up. She had just caught a sickening whiff of garlic on Anatoly's breath and felt the steely cold of his knife against her throat when something stood the room on its ear. A shockwave threw her and Sergi to the ground. Metal fragments and other debris ricocheted off the walls. Hot air roiled over them. She was woozy and nauseous and wanted nothing more than to press her face into the cool floor, but she knew she had to move. She half-turned in Sergi's embrace and fired an elbow into his eye. He stiffened and twisted away. She scrambled to her feet, finding her underwear still wrapped around one of her lug-soled boots. She yanked them up. The lights in the room were out, but a dim orange glow came from a connecting corridor. Sergi lay at her feet, squirming and coughing. The winemaker's wheelchair was blown over, and he lay in a fetal position on the ground beside it. Anatoly, a few feet behind Sergi, mimicked the winemaker's pose. Winnie realized how lucky she'd been with the explosion. The winemaker had been killed or knocked unconscious while in control of Anatoly's movements, so both of them were out of commission. Sergi was her main problem now. As if to reinforce the point, he lunged at her ankle. She dodged out of his reach and skipped past him to the spot Anatoly had discarded his shotgun. She had no idea where her own weapon lay, but Anatoly's gun was still there, half covered by a piece of the sliding steel door. It was then she understood that the blast had come from the exterior hallway. Reardon was bringing the cavalry. She fished the gun out by its barrel, reversed it, and seated the butt in her shoulder. The long barrel required more aiming than her sawed-off, but she had to make the best of it. With the stock gritty against her cheek, she advanced on Sergi, aligning the sights on a point between his eyes. She pumped off a round to no effect. She held the trigger down, slam-firing four more in quick succession. The first missed again, but as she closed her distance, angry swarms of buckshot decimated Sergi's face and skull. He reeled and fell backward. Anatoly was next. She straddled his body, putting the muzzle inches from his ear. She pumped the action, but it jammed mid-stroke. The spent shell was stuck, almost certainly from the way she'd abused the gun earlier. In frustration, she leaned down to swing the butt into his jaw, returning the favor he'd paid her. This seemed to have the opposite effect than she had intended. He shook his head, blinking his eyes open. He now moved of his own accord. She cocked her arm to take another swing, but he rolled onto her thigh, tipping her onto the floor. Winnie scrambled on her hands and knees away from him. She couldn't afford to let one of those bastards get hold of her again. She pivoted into an outside sweep kick, catching Anatoly hard in the shoulder. He snarled and struggled to his feet. Winnie had a brief opening for another kick, but what she saw then completely derailed her. Incredibly, Sergi, or the corpse of Sergi, was also lumbering to his feet. He ape-walked to where the winemaker lay, slung him over his shoulder, and bolted for the door. Anatoly spied his fellow Ukrainian on the move. He snarled again and charged. Winnie jumped out of his path, barely managing to hook his boot with hers. He fell, but quickly gained a knee. He stumbled to his feet and tore headlong through the exploded door, following on the heels of Sergi and the winemaker. She thought through what had happened. Yes, she had blasted Sergi in his frontal lobes to kingdom come, but his reptilian brain and his motor function remained. The winemaker had regained consciousness and realized that it was time to cut and run. He had switched horses to his faceless but functioning mount, leaving Anatoly to delay pursuit. He didn't delay it much. Winnie threaded her way through the debris of the sliding door and injected herself into the hallway. There, stretched out on the ground, was Reardon. He seemed to have tripped Anatoly yet again. She shouted his name, completely forgetting the injury to her jaw. A bubbling warmth flooded over her, and she imagined for a moment that she'd regained sensation.
"Are you okay?"
she asked, sorry that it came out more angry than concerned. "Yes." "Yes," he said. "Go." The winemaker and the other went out the back door. She hesitated for a moment. He didn't look okay. He looked spent and drawn. "Go," he shouted. She dipped her head in acknowledgement and slipped past Anatoly. She flew up the corridor and through the exterior door, expecting to see Sergi and the winemaker hoofing it down the road or struggling with the keyless van. She was disappointed. The corpse of the driver lay smeared across the gravel, and the van was on the move. Sergi's ruined visage mocked her from the driver's seat as he swept by. Apparently, there was more than one set of keys. Winnie took a half step after the van, but checked up when she heard shooting from the cave. She thought about going back to help Reardon, but she was diverted again by the sound of a crash. Rather than turning with a road, the van had gone straight into the transmission tower at the base of the neighboring hill. She glanced into the cave again, feeling an almost gravitational pull of guilt. But she couldn't help herself. She picked the van and the winemaker over helping Reardon. She came up to the driver's side and jerked the door open. Sergi's head lay against the steering wheel in nearly the same position as the original driver's had. The handle of a knife she recognized protruded from his shoulder, blood seeping from the wound. But the knife hadn't killed Sergi, and it hadn't caused the crash. Somehow, the winemaker had lost control. He lolled in his seat across the way, conscious, the first hint of fear clouding his eyes, but paralyzed. Winnie didn't know why they couldn't move, and she didn't care. She yanked the knife out of Sergi's shoulder and pulled his head up by his hair. She slit his throat from ear to ear, finishing the job she had begun with the shotgun. She could actually see white from a vertebrae when she released him, his head hinging open like a gruesome Pez dispenser. She walked purposely to the other side of the car, flinging excess blood from the knife as she strode. There was a certain irony in what she was going to do next. The knife, she knew, was Reardon's. He must have thrown it at the retreating pair. But more to the point, it was the same weapon he'd used in the very first encounter with the winemaker. She would gut the winemaker with it now. She would let him watch as his intestines spilled into his lap, and then she would cut his throat, exactly as she had cut Sergi's. She unlatched the passenger door, pulling it open slowly in an almost courtly fashion, as if she were a doorman at an expensive hotel. She knew the winemaker's ears still worked. She would say the last words he would hear on this earth. What issued from her mouth surprised her.
"See you in hell," she screamed.
But it was too late. She sensed immediately that he was dead. Heart failure, or a stroke, had finished him before she could take her revenge. She stepped away, the blade in her hand still dripping, and looked back to the cave. Reardon was there, dead or alive, no thanks to her. She had made her choice, both in what she had done and in what she had said, even if no one living would be able to recount it. Reardon came limping before she could go to find him. They embraced and kissed in spite of her broken jaw. When she explained what had happened, he seemed not to question, or even consider, her decision to pursue the winemaker. It didn't make her feel any less guilty. They compared notes on their injuries, and then Reardon called Ray on one of the burner phones. "He's been shot," he relayed to her with his palm over the receiver. "Sit tight," he told Ray, "and put some pressure on the wound. We'll be there in 15 minutes. Winnie hurried to retrieve her rental car so Reardon wouldn't have to walk on his injured ankle. On the way back, she heard a short burst of automatic weapons fire and accelerated into the turnaround, ready to ram whatever new threat had arisen. She found Reardon limping from the van to the car, the assault rifle slung over his shoulder.
"What was that about?"
"You said he had a heart attack. I wanted to be absolutely sure it was fatal." She nodded, paradoxically relieved that she hadn't been the one to do it and that it had been done. It wasn't smart to be anything less than 100% certain now. They found Ray on top of the mountain, sitting against the bumper of his old car with a wad of paper towels duct taped to his shoulder. He looked pale and shaken, but considering his age and the story he had to tell, surprisingly collected. When Winnie let him know how important jamming the winemaker's signals had turned out to be, that he had stopped the winemaker from making his escape, he became downright frisky. They agreed to split up. Ray's injury was a gunshot, and any attempt to get professional treatment would be reported to the police. Since Ray seemed to have controlled the bleeding with his garage mechanic's dressing, he and Reardon would drive south and find an emergency room far enough away that no one would connect the accidental shooting of an 80-year-old man with the Marionette Vineyards gun battle. Winnie would go to the nearby Queen of the Valley Hospital in Napa for treatment of her jaw. She'd blame it on a car accident and refuse to check into the hospital overnight. They would meet again in Palm Springs in 5 days' time. Winnie watched as Reardon helped Ray into the passenger seat of the Dodge and then limped around to where she stood by the other car. "You did it," he said, smiling his crooked smile. "We did it," she said. "All of us. You, Ray, me, and your crazy plan." "Our OCD fucked in the head plan?" "I still say it's OCD, but I withdraw the fucked part." She put her hands on his shoulders and leaned over to graze his forehead with her lips. "Take care of yourself, old man. I love you." Even in the dim light, she could see Reardon was surprised. Surprised and pleased. I love you too." She found his hand and squeezed it. "Goodbye." "Goodbye. See you soon." Winnie nodded as if she meant it, but she knew she wouldn't see him. She got into her car and caravaned with them to Napa, exiting at the turnoff for the hospital, but doubling back after waiting on a side street to be sure they had passed. Winnie drove to Marionette Vineyards, slowing only a little to rubberneck the armada of police and fire vehicles on the property before continuing north. When she crossed the Oregon border, Winnie told herself that their personalities were not compatible, that there was too much difference in their ages, and that eventually he would miss being with a woman who could feel. As she pulled away from the hospital in Seattle, she confessed to the empty passenger seat that she had been motivated by vengeance, not just at the cave, but always, while Reardon's sole motivation had been a desire to help and protect her. When Winnie arrived in British Columbia, she parked at a cove along the Sea to Sky Highway. She sat on a driftwood log at the end of a rocky beach far from everyone. The tide was rising, and the air was heavy with the dank smell of kelp. She rattled a clutch of pebbles in her palm and then tossed them, one by one, into the lapping waves. Funny, orange-beaked birds rushed to peck at the splashes. She didn't deserve August Reardon's love, however much she craved it. The best she could do now was spare him the inevitable heartbreak. The End. You have been listening to No Hard Feelings, a finalist for the Forward Reviews Book of the Year Award. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.